Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen talk radio show. My guest for this morning is novelist J.E. Fishman. As a well-versed traveled man, having experienced both sides of fame and fortune, J.E. brings his life's journey into perspective in his writings. J.E. and I will be discussing how he became a storyteller through his mystery and thriller novels. Good morning, J.E. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing great, Johnny. Thank you so much for having me.
It is a pleasure having you on the air. I mean, your latest book, The Dark Pool, is a very interesting read. There's no doubt in my mind you are a great storyteller. It's got suspense, it's very thrilling, and all I could say is that congratulations.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the compliment. That is my goal, is to be a storyteller, and that's the highest compliment you can pay me.
I believe that you are sort of a natural. We're going to get into the inner being of J.E. here in a little bit, but I have to tell you, it's just a natural. You just have this knack for creating things and the imaginations that you put in. And, of course, I'm sure there are a lot of life experiences as well that's tucked in those pages, so it's wonderful. Let us start by getting to know you a little better. Please give us a quick walkthrough of your life from childhood to the present moment.
Okay, well, the quick walkthrough, I was born on Long Island, very close to New York City. My father commuted to New York, and when I got older, started having jobs in New York, I would commute as well. I ended up going to Tufts University in Boston to college. Then I returned to New York and moved into Manhattan, as so many of us did in that era of the 1980s. I was a trade magazine journalist and then became a Doubleday editor. I left Doubleday as a senior editor and started my own literary agency and then did some other entrepreneurial things along the way, which I won't get too sidetracked into, but I did some things within the book business, including starting my own .com, which crashed and burned during the .com crash, but it was quite a wild ride while it lasted. So I sold my literary agency and returned home to lick my wounds. And was doing some ghostwriting. My wife and I also owned a retail store completely unrelated to the book business. So it was actually a horse supplies stores with a website. And we sold that, and we sold our house before the real estate meltdown. Mm-hmm. I thought the luck of this, of having sold our business before the crash and sold our house. It wasn't at the peak, but still we managed to get out. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, gosh, this is like a sign from a greater power, that I should return to what had always been my primary, interest, which mm-hmm. was I wanted to tell stories. And I had never gotten around to it because of sort of this greater sense of, practicality. And I thought, well, this is a gift now. I'm not getting any younger, and I need to pursue it. And so I started writing novels.
Very interesting. When you were growing up, were your parents an avid reader?
Yes, my father especially was a huge reader, and he had a little library. I don't want to make it sound too grand, but, he would mm-hmm. keep the books that he loved. And he was the kind of guy who didn't wait for the paperback. Mm-hmm. if there was a hot new hardcover out, he bought the hardcover and he'd pour through it. And I think I probably, emulated him. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because I don't really have this perception, but when I talk to, like, my sister will say, oh, gosh, right. I remember that you always had your face in a book, mm-hmm. And I do recall, beautiful sunny days. I mean, and I was mm-hmm. active. I mean, I played, baseball in the street with my mm-hmm. friends and played a lot of basketball when I was a kid growing up in high school and junior high school. But I do recall so many days where I was a beautiful day and I'd be inside reading and my parents saying, "It's a beautiful day. Why are you sitting here reading?" but it was just something that called to me.
What kind of books intrigued you when you were growing up?
You know, it was pretty much, you know, I would say it was a wide range. There were certainly, it's funny because I don't think of myself, here I am writing thrillers and mysteries at the mm-hmm. moment, and I don't think of myself as, you know, being exclusively interested as a reader in any single genre. But when I think back on the books that really lit my excitement for reading mm-hmm. fiction, I think back to like The Exorcist, which came out, I think I was 9 years old. And my recollection of reading The Exorcist was it was the first book that I read, you know, almost literally in one sitting. I could not put that book down. You know, it was, I started it in the morning and, you know, by the next day I was finished with it. And a few years later, Jaws coming out. Jaws was a big, just a sort of big event, a literary, you know, event, the way that book, you know, caught on. But on the other hand, I also read a lot of nonfiction. You know, when I was growing up, I don't practice Judaism, but I was culturally mm-hmm. brought up Jewish, and in those days, you know, in the 70s. If you grew up with a Jewish background, there was still a great fascination with the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. And I did a lot of reading about you know, nonfiction about Nazi Germany and, you know, and the Holocaust and, you know, just read a lot of history, biblical history, you know, that sort of thing. And, you know, I just had this sense of you know, books opening up a window to the greater world.
Very interesting. That's a big switch about reading books to writing them, or writing articles in this case. When did you realize you have a talent for writing?
Well, I think probably early in junior high school, I started to write short stories, and I would show them to my teachers. So clearly, I didn't want to, you know, I wanted to get some, you know, reaction from people. I'd show them to my parents, and I'd show them to my, mm-hmm. you know, to my teachers, and you know, I recall always that, you know, when it came to, you know, English classes and you know, so on, that people, you know, teachers were always, you know, complimenting, you know, my writing. And, you know, it always just came, you know, a little bit easier to me than a lot of other things. And, you know, we tend to like to do things that, you know, that come easily to us. And so I kept just delving, you know, deeper and deeper into it. Now, that said, I did spend, you know, once I, you know, went off into the professional world, I was an editor for a long time. And as a literary agent, you also spend a lot of time editing. If you're good, you know, if you're a good literary agent anyway. But so I sort of, you know, got away from doing my own writing, you know, for a long time. But I always, you know, I went through life, I feel like, always thinking, you know, as a writer, you know, thinking of stories, thinking of people's motivations, you know, for things, mm-hmm, thinking of mm-hmm. interesting, you know, interesting premises, you know, for stories. And so, you know, when I finally got back to really committing myself to it, mm-hmm. you know, I felt like I had already sort of seeded the ground.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Interesting. Do you daydream a lot when you were growing up?
You know, I probably did. I also had, you know, I think so many, you know, writers, you know, I don't consider myself to have had a traumatic, you know, childhood in mm-hmm. that, you know, I grew up, you know, reasonably, you know, well off. My father had a good job and stuff, and he was increasingly prosperous as I got older. But I did have, mm-hmm. I was touched by tragedy in that my mother died when I was 12. And if I look, you know, back on that, I think mm-hmm. a lot of what, you know, called me to write was somehow, you know, dealing with that, because mm-hmm. that's really mm-hmm. when I started to commit myself to writing. And even though I didn't sit down and write a great deal about her death, mm-hmm. I think it must have connected to me somehow, because I do find myself, I mean, just as an example, my first novel has a scene where this woman, the heroine, her mother is dying. And I certainly, you know, I didn't think of my mother. I mean, I didn't think, let me find a way to work in my personal experience, you know, into this scene. But it just was there for me, and it sort of just had to be there. So, to answer your question, I mean, it was probably around that time where I really began to connect with writing, although I suspect a lot of it was, you know, was sort of subconscious.
Sure. So do you use your writing to express your feelings rather than entertaining others, so to speak?
Well, you know, that's the thing. I mean, I think that, you know, when you talk about writing or storytelling, there's sort of, you know, there's text and then there's subtext,
right?
And I think that, you know, and there are many different, you know, terms for that, and, you know, in psychology and in writing and storytelling of all kinds. But what it really comes down to is there's sort of, you know, why we know we do things and other reasons we may do things that we're not as in touch with. And for me, I've always wanted to write for others to read. I'm not one of these people who keeps a secret diary, as a way to discover my own feelings and then sticks it in a drawer and doesn't want anybody to see it. You know, if I wrote a diary, Johnny, I think I would probably, I'd be one of those people who secretly wants somebody to discover my diary. as opposed to locking it away, I would leave the key out somewhere for somebody to find. Because for me, it's about, you know, writing is about connecting. Storytelling is about connecting. And if you're going to connect, you have to have an audience, you know, and it can't. And the audience, I understand that for some people, that audience looking in the metaphorical mirror is enough for them. But that's never been enough for me. I want to connect to people. I want to I want to share my view of the world a little bit with people.
Very interesting. And in your life experiences too, based on your bio, you have basically experienced a whole lot in your lifetime, good, bad, or whatever, it's indifference here, but it's just a matter of being able to flavor all the different things in life. And I've always viewed life as a buffet line. You go through that line and you flavor everything, and sometimes you don't have much of a choice.
That's
what
right.
You. But nonetheless, you have to just go with the flow in so many ways. So what life experiences influence your writing most?
Well, I think that's exactly right. I mean, it's sort of, there was a famous line from I'm forgetting her name. Oh, Carrie, the woman who played on Star Wars, and she had a one woman show. Carrie Fisher, thank you. And she had a great line in that show where she said, you know, because she talks about how, you know, she had these adventures with drug abuse and some degree of mental illness, and she blames her parents and so on. But then she says, but my brother, you know, turned out completely normal. And she comes to the conclusion, it's not what you get, it's how you take it.
Right.
And I think you're absolutely right about the buffet line, that to some degree, yes, our choices are always, our experiences are limited in some fashion by fate. But it's how you process that stuff. And, as I mentioned, my mother dying, I think I processed that in a certain way. But then there are other many, you know, very small things. I mean, just as an example, in The Dark Pool, which is my new novel, one of the bad guys in that novel is a janitor at a high school. Now, I, of course, like everybody else, I went to high school. I went to a public high school, although not in the city, and this is more of an inner city public high school. But when I was ghostwriting, I had an opportunity to meet a high school coach who had his own special story, and I was up to be his ghostwriter on the story. I didn't get the job, but what I did get was a tour of this inner city high school. So, you know, that sort of helps me form the basis of just a sense of place of this high school for the scenes when they're in the high school in the novel. And when I was in college myself, I had a job one summer working as a fill-in janitor in an office building. And coming as sort of an upper-middle-class, kid who really, you know, had never, you know, been, you know, tested, you know, that well.
Right.
It's not as if I was not working my way through you know, college or high school or any, you know, that kind of thing. But this was a thing where it was every 2 weeks the shift would change, and sometimes, you know, it was midnight to 8 o'clock in the morning. I was alone, locked in this office building, and you know, having to do all the scut work that a janitor mm-hmm. in an office building has to do. And so, you know, and so when you sort of draw on these things, and have a sense of what it is to drag a mop across the floor and to be there alone in this building where this janitor in the dark pool, you know, he's a bad guy. I hope I'm a good guy, but I have a sense of what that guy, you know, does,
yeah.
and what it's like to be, you know, in that building. And so, you find these, you know, these little life experiences and you tap them. And it's funny because sometimes the big life experience plays a very small part in any given story. And sometimes the smallest life experience you have, you know, might play a very, you know, large part, you know, and such as having lived, it so happens, in the Hudson Valley outside of New York among some of these very wealthy, and some just moderately wealthy, mm-hmm. You know, Wall Street traders and hedge fund managers. I would see these people at cocktail parties. I would play tennis mm-hmm. with some of them. I once played tennis mm-hmm. several times at a billionaire's house.
And I
got a little bit of a sense of how they, you know, of how they tick, which also, you know, helped me craft the characters in this novel, The Dark Pool.
Mm-hmm. What you just mentioned is the fact that, say, an ordinary kid, I would say in this case, if they, you know, they grew up in the sense of that middle class or lower class or whatever you want to call it, in terms of if they had gone out there and do the same work that you did, they may have taken it for granted because that's life, that's usual, this is what I see every day. But having you going in, and this is interesting as well, because you actually paid attention, you were very perceptive, this is something new to you. So as you go out there and experience life, and we talk about flavoring that various food in the buffet line again,
right.
And you were able to really turn up your level of perception of things and have a different sense of appreciation, because this is part of that learning aspect. The education you're getting is not from the textbook, but this is life. And you somehow are able to capture those wonderful moments, good or bad, it's just different than what you're normally used to, and you have a different sense of appreciation for those things. Very interesting.
Yeah, it's funny, you know, I can't I have a vivid recollection of mm-hmm. you know, mopping the floor in an office building.
Yeah.
But if you ask me to remember a date or a number that's more than 2 weeks old, I can't, you know, I have a lot of trouble remembering. So I guess I chose the right profession as far as that goes. I think these things are, you know, I look at, you know, with regard to my work and my life, I look at these mm-hmm. things as, you know, sort of points of departure, as ways into a character,
right.
ways, you know, into a story. And one of my favorite quotes that I'm pretty sure Henry James, the great 19th century American mm-hmm. novelist, or he was in exile, self-exile, mm-hmm. lived in Europe most of his life, but he had a great line, which I seldom see quoted. He mm-hmm. said, in order to write about dying, one only needs to have had a bad cold. and I think, you know, this really speaks to this idea that, you know, that you don't need to have every life experience in order to create, you know, well-rounded characters and interesting
right.
stories, but you need to open yourself up to the possibilities.
Very true. I think those times that you were out in the world, in different world, that is, away from what you are used to normally, that really sort of accentuate your perceptions about the rest of the world, and it gave you the foundation to build upon in your writings. And whether it's by design, consciously or subconsciously, you went with the flow, basically. That's what you did. And then you just took snapshots, mental snapshots of all these things that you've encountered. And kind of when the moment is right, and we talk about switching to a Mac here before we got on the air, you basically downloaded all this stuff in your writings.
Yeah, I mean, we all have. I mean, you know, it's interesting because we all have, you know, to some degree, you know, equal experiences, you know, and if you're 51 years old, you've, you know, lived as much life as I have in terms of mm-hmm. how many minutes you've, you know, you've been on Earth. It so happens that I don't have the most interesting life, you know, in the world. And if I did, I guess I'd be writing memoirs, right? But but I think that smorgasbord you're talking about, that buffet mm-hmm. you're talking about, there have been, I think, over the years, I've probably had more variety, mm-hmm. On that buffet than many people, have, and I've been fortunate in that way. I just personally, I'm interested in the spectrum of humanity. I'm not interested in locking myself up with one group or one, social class. I've always sort of looked at myself as a little bit of a bridge builder, just even socially, where I'll introduce people who otherwise wouldn't have met each other. And that's sort of how I've looked at life also. I mean, whoever I'm, talking to, tapping into, I try to see the world from their, perspective a little bit, and then I use that, in my fiction.
Mm-hmm. So please tell us about the plot of your latest novel, The Dark Pool.
Well, there's the hero, there are almost two heroes, but there's really one. It's a guy named Shug Clay, and he's a very successful inner-city high school football coach. He's so successful that he's under pressure to move up to a higher level. These colleges are trying to hire him, and his brother, who's a Wall Street type, who helped arrange for funding for the football program, is pressuring him to move up. Why wouldn't you want to move up? But for Shug, it's all about the kids, and he doesn't want to leave these kids behind, and they're inner city kids, and he's really almost quite literally saved a lot of their lives. And one of those kids in particular gets into some trouble. And at first it looks like, that kid's named Antoine Meeps. And at first it looks like Antoine, was just a kid who's made some, bad decisions. But, as they say, the plot thickens and, trouble deepens. And it turns out that there's a dark pool marketplace, which is a kind of a secret marketplace. They're betting on a thing called Q scores, which is a measure of fame. And so essentially, you've got these wealthy, traders mm-hmm. In the secret pool, making bets on whether Shug is going to become more famous or less famous.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
they've decided, or some of them have, not to stop at that. And since it's secret, and their identities are unknown, they've started to manipulate his life, and this player has gotten caught up in it. And so here's Shug, he's sort of this regular guy, this everyman, although he's successful in his own way, who is suddenly up against these forces that are more powerful than him, and that at first he doesn't even understand, who are manipulating his life for their own gain. He and his player Antoine have to get to the bottom of it, quite literally, before they get killed.
Like I say, your book is a very interesting read. You're a great storyteller. What inspired you to write a financial thriller?
Well, the events, of course, of a few years ago, where the financial crash, and there's been so mm-hmm. much done on that, in the media, and God knows there's been there's been some vilification of hedge fund managers or mm-hmm. Wall Street mm-hmm. types. And. Then there's the other side of, people who say, oh, no, it's not their fault, America brought it on itself and all
right.
that. And I wanted to get to something I think is not as well discussed, because I think that, there's a saying from a great philosopher that tragedy occurs when two rights conflict. And
mm-hmm.
and to some degree, people don't have to be, it's not a question necessarily of good or evil. I mean, I truly believe that a lot of the Wall Street people are greedy, but then again, lots of people are greedy. We're all greedy.
Mm-hmm.
It's a human characteristic. In fact, it's rare not to be greedy,
mm-hmm.
They took it to a certain extent beyond what turned out to be prudent and what turned out to be good for the country. What intrigues me is, how do you end up with that, detachment? And
right.
I think that we all, to some degree, especially, in the modern age, do that. And these guys are sitting there staring at a screen all day. and trying to win. And they press a button, and a trade occurs. And that trade, maybe they made a little bit of money, maybe they lost a little bit of money, maybe they made a lot of money, maybe they lost a lot of money if they ended up on the wrong side of the trade. But for them, it's just a trade. But for some guy or woman on Main Street, USA, those guys with their trading might have just destroyed a company.
Right.
And that person might be, out of a job. And so that intrigues me, these unintended consequences and this, detachment from the moral consequences of what you're doing. Now, because it's a thriller, it's fiction, and one sort of has to amp up the story and sort of take it to the extreme, right?
Right.
So there are some people in this novel who are truly bad people who have made really bad moral choices beyond simply pressing a button and making a trade. But what they are doing is they've in effect, in the realm of storytelling, they've taken this, to an extreme, what the activity that's happening sort of on a spectrum, and I think that it's sort of like the frog in the boiling water, which turns out to be a myth, but nevertheless, it's a great metaphor.
Right.
I mean, the frog will in fact jump out of the water when it gets too hot. It's a great metaphor, and it's people, I think, a lot of times, God knows there are some bad people in the world, truly bad.
Right.
But I think most people, when they do bad things, they make bad decisions, they get there in increments. And it's only when they turn and look back behind them, they realize, my gosh, how did I end up way over here? I started out maybe in moral ambiguity, and now I'm a bad guy. And so I thought this was an interesting, way to bring this out, because dark pools are very real. In fact, they're a real danger to the system now. Yet another thing cropping up, right? A third of all trades of what are supposed to be publicly traded stocks are happening now in these dark pools, away from oversight, and the intention is to hide their trades. They might have perfectly good legal reasons that they want to hide their trades, but what happens in the dark tends to corrupt things. Light is an antiseptic, and the lack of light is the opposite of an antiseptic. and so I hit upon combining this dark pool thing with another thing that's real, which is Q scores, which is just a perfectly benign measure of somebody's fame and endorsement potential. If you have the highest Q score, you're the guy they put on the Wheaties box. But so I hit upon that as a way to connect these dots, that somebody presses a button and somebody else ends up with their life ruined.
Very interesting. How much research did you do before you write the book?
What I always try to do is as little research as possible, because I'm
interesting.
Lazy. It's back to that Henry James quote.
Yeah.
But so what I do is, I'm an investor myself, so I've been paying attention to the stock market and Bloomberg and all that thing for a very long time. I lived among some of these people, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, and so I sort of had this base of knowledge. And so I did start to poke around and do some research, and then fortunately, just as luck would have it, a friend of mine, in fact, my oldest friend in the world, literally, I grew up with him. We were playing, we used to play ball together around the corner from one another, from the earliest age. He went on to become a successful money manager and hedge fund manager, manages billions and billions of dollars. It's always great when you can find a real life expert, not just read about this stuff. And so I was able to tap into his expertise, it's very helpful because I'm trying to craft a story that has a basis in reality, but then you're taking it to an extreme, but you want it to remain plausible. And so for me, it's really helpful to be able to have this guy and say, could this happen? Could that happen? I'm not saying did it happen, will it happen? But is it possible for this, to happen? And so to have that sounding board, that was the real, thing that helped me gel this story from a research perspective more than all the reading that I did.
Very interesting. How did you come up with the various characters, though? Because I thought you hit on the nail in terms of marrying Wall Street with athletics in some ways, because that's what's actually going on in the real world.
Yeah, you know, the novel really fundamentally is not about football. You know, and everybody has to have a job, and so there's a context, and it's not that much about that. But to come back to what you just said, you know, there is an element of exploitation, you know, in all of this, you know, and just as there's this exploitation to some degree, you know, in, as you say, in amateur sports. You know, in high school and college sports, it's kind of bold. You know, I mean, it's not really, nobody really even tries to disguise it. They might rationalize it, but they don't really disguise it. It's right out there. And I think that there's a level of, you know, of exploitation, in this broader, you know, sense also in the way the financial, you know, system is structured. And so, you know, as far as, you know, where the characters come from, you know, they arise from 100, you know, little decisions that you make. And, you know, I always, you know, when people talk about, like, some people have writer's block, I think the source of writer's block is that every time you make a decision, you close off, a whole lot of other possibilities, you know, right? And so when people are writers are staring at the blank page, the blank page is a kind of perfection, right? You know, the blank page is like you wake up in the morning before you get out of bed, you know, and the second you get out of bed, things start to happen in your day, you know, your day starts to happen, right? And you know, that perfection can be very intimidating for people. And I think the reason why writers sometimes get blocked is they look at that blank page, and the second you put one word down, say you write the word she, you just cut all your possibilities in half. You said, "Well, it's not a he; it's a she," right? And then you put them in America instead of putting them in France, and your possibilities narrow. And so what happens, you know, as far as the moral journey, character, you know, eventually those characters start to make decisions for themselves. So you create a character by making a lot of little sort of minor, they're almost insignificant choices from the perspective of the reader, but they begin to put a character in a place where that you can't walk them back, and then they are confronted with a difficult decision, you know, a moral decision, and how they respond to that begins to have a certain kind of inevitability if you do it right. So the characters sort of arise from the 100 decisions that you make as a writer. And then they complete themselves with the decisions that they make. And you almost can't help it, because if you try to impose a decision on them as a writer, once you've sort of gotten to know them as characters, you know immediately whether that decision works or not. You can't just say, well, it would really be convenient for me if this person, picked door A instead of door B. but this person would never pick door A because they were afraid of vowels, or something, right? So that's where the characters come from. You know, they come at first from these little details, and then later they come from the big decisions that they make.
Interesting. So how much of you is in the book?
You know, I think that I find it hard to believe that you know, every writer is not to some degree in every character that they write, because that character comes from their head. Now, the thing is that rarely do authors fully come out and admit that, and I think partly that's because they don't do it. They don't make the decision to do it. You know, they don't say, rarely. I mean, I don't want to say anything absolutely, but. Yeah. Rarely do they make the decision. Does anybody make a decision and say, "Well, I want to create a character, and he's going to be just like me"? The person who I think was most honest about this, in my experience, a couple of years ago, I saw Lee Child speak, the author of the Jack Reacher books, and he said, "You know, who do people ask? People ask me who is Jack Reacher, and he says Jack Reacher is me." But for me, I think that, you know, I think I'm in my good guys and in my bad guys, and you know, I never say to myself, oh, let me make this person just like me. In fact, you sort of try to get outside of yourself, but you can only get as you can only get so far outside of yourself because, you know, it all comes from your own, you know, perceptions, you know, of the world. My first novel, the protagonist is a is a woman. And it was interesting because I found I was very self-conscious. You know, she had to be a woman. I just knew she had to be a woman. It wanted to be a woman, right? But where could I go? I was very self-conscious about that decision at first. And so I wrote a lot of stuff in there, you know, to try to prove that, you know, J.E. Fishman knows, you know, all the stuff about what it is to be a woman. And you know, as the story evolved, I ended up cutting all that stuff out because it was all trying too hard. You know,
right.
it wasn't really stuff I knew. I was like trying to prove, you know, something, and it didn't really come from my heart. It came from my head. So to some degree, so once I sort of, you know, got rid of all the garbage about this character whose name is Leanne. Then I have to say probably, you know, some of that is me, or it's the person I wish I could be. You know, I mean, I think if it's a bad guy, it's sort of maybe a little bit, you know, the person you hope you're not, but it's probably in there somewhere. There's no crime against, you know, having, you know, bad thoughts, right? You know, I mean, sometimes people think, you know, gosh, how did you come up with that crazy scene where so-and-so,
right.
Well, I came up with it. I can't blame it on somebody else, right? But,
right.
But, so I guess I'm somewhere a little bit, you know, in that, you know, scene. Now, there is a character in The Dark Pool who's a giant squid. Well, you know, I was going to say, I like to think that I don't have any giant squid in me, but maybe I do.
Yeah.
Right, because the giant squid, I think, is a very sympathetic character in the novel.
Very interesting. So, what do you like most about writing the book? Were there challenges to whereby I hate doing this, and then there are times where you felt like, wow, this is a great part of the book that I really, really enjoyed because it's a natural for me, and then versus there are other aspects of the book that, well, I got to create something because it sort of balances the equation, so to speak.
Well, you know, there's nothing. Writing, even for those, it comes more easily to some than it comes to others. But I think it also, at any given moment, might come more easily than other times. And there certainly are times when you feel like you just have to push yourself through. And you know, the only way to overcome doubt about a story that you're telling or about whether you're doing a good job of it, or, you know, is to push through, you know, to the next scene and the next paragraph, the next chapter. And so certainly there are some times that are not fun, where you doubt, you know, you might be halfway through and you doubt what you're doing, and you usually, even if you do an outline, and I happen to use an outline when I write most of the time, usually, you know, you don't really have it all fully thought out because you can't, you know, because these characters, as I said earlier, they do sort of take over a little bit. And so there'll be a moment in the writing of a novel where I think, oh, boy, you know, and I've written myself onto the edge of a cliff here and I have no idea, you know, you know, what to do. Have I, you know, well, maybe a better metaphor is a blind alley. You know, have I, I've gotten myself into this blind alley. You know, how am I going to get out of this? Or, you know, this is just, you know, all the possibilities seem, you know, so boring or something. And then something will just suddenly hit you. And frequently it's toward the end of a novel where you realize, wait a second, you know, here's what that character needed, you know, to do earlier in order to pay this off really well, you know, at the end. Or you'll think, you know, gosh, I thought, you know, this person was the bad guy, but this other person is really, you know, is really the bad guy, or is worse, you know, or is really behind this in some way that I didn't, you know, it didn't occur to me when I started out. And when you have those moments, they're almost like, you know, it's almost like when you put, when you cook Jell-O, you know, mm-hmm. right? And you put the, you know, we all do this, right? You cook the Jell-O, you pour it into the little bowls or the big bowl, you put it in the refrigerator, you close the refrigerator, and then what do? 3 minutes later, you open the refrigerator, look to see whether the Jell-O is ready, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's
mm-hmm.
it's all settled and it's still. But you know it's not ready. It's only been 3 minutes, you know, right? And so you know, there's that moment, and you're never really there for it when it's Jell-O, you know, unless you're completely obsessed. But
yeah.
you know, there's that moment. 1 second it's liquid, and the next second it's Jell-O,
mm-hmm.
and that same thing sort of happens in a novel. And that's the most satisfying moment when mm-hmm. suddenly it just all comes together for you. And mm-hmm. you realize that all this effort has not been for naught, that this actually, you know, this thing that you've created actually is starting to make sense, you know,
yeah.
and it's
yeah.
starting to all tie together, and it's starting to gel, you know, it's a kind of a clarification. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you know, you go back and you're an editor. It can be fun editing yourself if you have the right mm-hmm. attitude about it. And you, you know, you take out all the stuff where you really messed it up, or you maybe worded things badly, or you maybe
mm-hmm.
made
mm-hmm.
something that doesn't really ring true for that character anymore. Maybe it was a placeholder. Mm-hmm. You just put it there to, you know, get mm-hmm. through it. But then that feeling when that thing really comes together and you really feel it gel. I mean, that's the best for me. That's the best feeling of the world. That makes all the rest of the effort, you know, worth it. The only feeling better than that is having somebody tell you they read your book and they liked it.
That's very true, because it just adds a certain amount of to it. Having someone else, it gives you the validation
exactly
about how great your work is, and so I agree with that. Very true. Where can someone go to get your book and get more information about you?
Well, to get more information about me, the best place to start is jefishman.com, jefishman.com, and from there you can, you know, go to, you see a lot of the stuff about what I'm working on, and my social media contacts are all connected to from there. The books are all available on Amazon. Mm-hmm. Primacy is available in bookstores. Cadaver Blues, my mystery, which we didn't, mm-hmm. you know, didn't have a chance to talk about, but that mm-hmm. is available in all the big online venues of Barnes and Noble and Amazon and so on, iBooks as well, mm-hmm. and The Dark Pool is at the moment only available on Amazon, but will shortly be available in all those other venues mm-hmm. As well.
Wonderful. What would you like for your readers to gain from reading the various books that you have out there?
Well, you know, the biggest thing is I really, you know, I just want people to be entertained. I want people to laugh at the funny parts and to, you know, mm-hmm. cry at the sad parts, and you know, just to be moved, because I think you know, if I don't entertain you, then nothing else matters. The fact that there might be a little bit of a message, you know, there, or just even an insight into the human condition, will
right.
only come once you've opened up emotionally to it. And the only way to open up emotionally is to you know, be moved, whether it's a little bit of fear or a suspense, or, as I said, you know, to laugh or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is, you know, I just want people to turn the pages, to be entertained, to want to know, you know, what happens next. And only once I've accomplished that, you know, I think, you know, the subject of all fiction to some degree is to contemplate how every action has a consequence.
Mm-hmm.
And whether it's something we do to somebody else or something we do to ourselves, you know, to think about, you know, how would I have made a different decision or a similar, you know, decision, and just to you know, hopefully get just the tiniest little insight, you know, into the human condition, mm-hmm. you know, once you're finished, you know, with these books. I do try to have all my characters, you know, go through a journey, and they're different at the end than they were at the beginning.
That's sort of a lesson learned kind of thing in all of your books. You mentioned just now about messages, so it just depends on how individuals read the books, correct?
Yeah, and maybe better than messages, I would say maybe it's a you know, their themes.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
some of those themes I sort of set out, you know, to write early on, and others, you know, the novel sort of settles into a theme. I mean, as an example, my mystery, Cadaver Blues, the main character there is named Fook Goldberg, P-H-U-O-C, Goldberg. And he's a Vietnamese, ethnic Vietnamese, who was adopted as an infant by Jewish socialists. And so that's how he grew up on, you know, on Long Island. So he's kind of this you know, conflicted, you know, character. And I realized, because he's 100% American, and yet, you know, people look at him a little bit differently, and they can't pronounce his name, and, you know, they make presumptions about the fact just because he's Asian, they make presumptions about him which are not true, out of their own ignorance and out of their own prejudices. And yet, Fook himself is prejudiced. Why? Because we're all prejudiced. You know, we all have our prejudices.
Right.
We're not all racist. I'm not saying that, but we all have our prejudices. We all make assumptions about people based upon how they look or where they come from or, you know, what kind of job they have. That may or may not be correct. And so, you know, it's a mystery, and the mystery, you know, has itself, you know, on the surface has nothing to do with, you know, prejudice, but that's a theme that runs through that book because it's both, because to some degree, you know, it's him coming to terms with his own, you know, prejudices, which end up getting him into trouble because he makes some, you know, he's the guy who's got to solve this case, and he makes some bad assumptions, you know, based upon his own prejudice against women, for example, or against against fat people, you know. And so so he's got, you know, and so these themes come through, and I think, you know, hopefully the fun of it is, sure, you get entertained and you're trying to figure out who did it and all this stuff. But I think there's also what fun is, there's the resonance once you put a book down, and a week later you're no longer thinking about, gee, I wonder who did it, because you know who did it. You're not thinking about, well, I wonder, well, you know, how the bad guy's going to die or something, because you know how the bad guy dies because you finished the book. But what you are thinking about, maybe just a little bit in the back of your mind, is that theme. And, you know, gee whiz, I wonder if I'm like that. You know, I wonder if I look at the world just a little bit differently because I took this journey with this character.
Right. I love the way you phrase it, because that's the afterthought, the aftertaste that you want to leave in someone.
Right.
And hopefully that moves them in a positive way.
That's right. So, exactly.
Are you working on anything else right now?
Yeah, so I'm working on a screenplay, which I won't talk about, but I'm also working on a series of books that I'm hoping will come out later this year or early next year. We haven't exactly figured out how we're going to go about it, but it's a series of books on the NYPD bomb squad. The series will be called Bomb Squad NYC.
Mm-hmm.
The first novel is entitled The Danger to Himself and Others, and I'm really excited about them. They're police procedural thrillers. They're the stories of everyday heroes, the guys in the NYPD bomb squad. There, if you can believe it, there are only three dozen. I say guys; they happen to all be men at the moment. They have occasionally had women, and there will eventually be a woman character. But in real life, there are three dozen guys who are tasked with keeping all of New York City safe from bombings. And so, you know, any everyday hero, I mean, they go, you know, these are the guys when somebody, you know, screams bomb, these are the guys who run, in the direction of the bomb when everybody else is running away from it. These are the guys who literally at times have to stand over a device that they know. You know, it's one thing to be shot from sort of across the street where, you know, you can duck. These guys go to a bomb, and they'll stand over a bomb, knowing that if even when they're wearing the suit, the famous bomb suit, it doesn't necessarily protect them completely. I mean, for example, they don't use gloves. They don't wear gloves. They need their hands to defuse the bombs. And so, you know, they know that this is a great danger to them, and yet they will stand over that device. And they, you know, they have all this sort of, the NYPD bomb squad is the most technologically sophisticated bomb squad in the world. They see, just because of New York being New York, they see more cases, they go out on more calls than any bomb squad, you know, in the world. And yet, at bottom, it's about trying to outthink the bomb maker. To some degree, it is a it is a test of wits between these guys, all of whom are very bright, sort of analytical guys. None of them has a death wish, you know, yet they risk their lives every day. And so these books are about a series of them about that, and it's also about their personal lives, how they go home. You know, they've got to lay it on the line every day, and then they go home, you know, just like anybody else, and have to deal with the fact that their wife is angry with them, or, you know, their kid is talking back, or, you know, they maybe have some personal problems. Some of them, one of the main characters is a former EOD, Army guy. He's damaged from that, but he's a hero, and he's laying it on the line every day. And so, so I'm very excited about the series, and I have, as my technical consultants, two of the biggest bomb techs in the country, even in the world. One of them is the actual commander of the NYPD bomb squad, the active current commander, who is a technical consultant on this book. So the series of books. So they'll all be, technically, quite accurate.
Fantastic. Do you get a chance to go out to the site whenever these guys get called?
I did not go on a call. I don't know that they'll allow anybody to go on a call. I have been in the building where their headquarters is and had a tour and interviewed a lot of the guys, including guys who were there when the attempted bombing of Times Square, the car bomb in Times Square. These guys were there. I spoke to the guys who defused that bomb. I also... They put me in the bomb suit, which was really interesting to be inside that bomb suit. It weighs 60 pounds.
Wow.
And and it's heavy and it's bulky and you put the helmet on and it's noisy because there's a ventilator that's going once you put the helmet on it gives you a completely new perspective on life, Johnny.
I'm sure it does. At the same time, when you want to write about something like that, you have to be immersed in the situation in some ways.
That's right. I'll tell you, you know, you do. You can have somebody explain to you how claustrophobic that is, but when they tell you, first of all, when they put you the suit in, you see for yourself.
Yeah.
But also, just as an example, I mean, you can be. They told me there have been people who wanted to join the bomb squad, and they're. You know, you have to be a cop to start with, so you've climbed up the ranks and you've decided that you want to specialize in this, and it really interests you, and it's one of the most elite units, in the NYPD, and guys will get, they'll have jumped through all the hoops you have to jump through, and then before they accept them, they put them in the bomb suit, and some people freak out.
Right.
You know, these are cops. Yeah. They're brave people. They're well-meaning. Yeah. They want to do it, but they can't handle it. You know, they can't handle being in that thing. A lot of this is like any highly specialized unit. A lot of it is about the trust among the guys. So those are things you get insights from talking to them. You get insights from climbing into the suit, seeing the equipment. You know, there's some very technical equipment and the robots and all that stuff. It's really interesting stuff. And these guys are real heroes.
I envy you in some ways because there'd be a really cool research to do and having the opportunity to write a series about these guys. Basically, they're heroes in many ways.
Yeah, they are, and it's really cool. It's really cool to talk to them, and they're very, they're very almost, you know, philosophical about it. You know, about knowing that they're living with danger every day, and I think that. You know, big city cops can be the most ironic, you know, people on earth because they know that, nothing is really, in their world, nothing is exactly as it seems, you know, or often.
Right.
Often things are not, you know, as they seem.
Right.
And they learn that, you know, they learn that very quickly, and it gives them a unique, I don't want to say cynical, but a sort of skeptical, you know, very cool skepticism about, about, you know, everything. And it's interesting to you know, to talk to these guys and ask them questions, and they, and it's funny because they know that what they're doing is life and death, and yet on some level they don't take themselves too seriously. I've laughed with all these guys, you know, and because they know it's just crazy. It's just life is crazy, you know.
Right, right. That's wonderful. By the way, we're coming close to the end of the hour. Since our show is about people, family, and living life, would you like to share a recipe for living with our listeners this morning?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, I would say, you know, for me, my recipe of living is taste everything. You know, don't let that plate pass you by without sticking your fork in it. Watch everything. Read everything you can. You can't read everything. You can't watch everything, but don't miss an opportunity. Travel everywhere you can travel, that you can afford to travel, that you have the means to travel to. Keep thinking and you know, keep learning. I mean, life, you know, I think, Johnny, you said it best. Life is a smorgasbord, you know, and so, you know, indulge. You don't know. I always tell my daughter, I've always made my daughter taste everything.
Right.
She doesn't have to eat it, but she has to taste it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really how we should, you know, we should go through life is, you know, taste everything that you can bring yourself to taste.
Don't let it pass by you, and at least you acknowledge how it feels like, tastes like, and looks like.
Yeah, that's right. And I think also, you know, I love to travel, and you know, you might, some people look at travel as they just, you know, tick off the, oh, I saw that cathedral, I saw that,
right,
you know, museum. But for me, travel is really about seeing that, you know, that the way that you happen to choose to live or were raised and how to live is not necessarily the way. That plenty of people, there are plenty of legitimate ways to go about being a human being, and it's fascinating to see how other people go about it.
Once you flavor life to the fullest, like you suggest, you have a different perspective about the people around you and the environment around you. You have a different sense of appreciation.
That's right. You see how other people live, and then you can. It gives you a filter through which to re-examine your own, you know, choices. Mm-hmm. Because most of the things that where we are in life is mostly the result of the choices that we've made.
Mm-hmm. Very true.
And
very
if
true.
You made those choices, you can make other choices if you don't like where you are.
Right. We are living in the global community now, and so everything counts, everything matters, and if we want to live underneath a coconut shell, like what my mom would say, then you're missing out.
That's right. I like that, living underneath the coconut shell.
Yes.
And out from under that coconut shell.
That's right. There you go. Well, Jay, thank you very much for the great recipe for living and for spending this hour with me from My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. To all our listeners, thank you for being with us. Please join me next Tuesday morning. My guest will be Dr. Kathy Groover. She is a mind-body medicine expert. Dr. Groover will be sharing tips from her award-winning book, The Alternative Medicine Cabinet, on how to apply natural remedies and better lifestyle routines to maintain your youth and add years to your life. For additional information about this show and future shows, please go to FromMyMamasKitchen.com. Thank you for listening and have a blessed week. J.E., thank you again and have a blessed day.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.